for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. At a crowded market in eastern Afghanistan yesterday, a man blew himself up next to his apparent target, a pro-government militia commander. At least 9 people died, including the commander and 4 children. A Pentagon report says 1 in 5 detainees at Guantanamo Bay joins or rejoins a militant group after being released. And Yemeni officials say the Nigerian student accused of trying to blow up a U.S. airliner on Christmas Day had met with al-Qaeda operatives in eastern Yemen. Joining me to talk about these stories and more on the Friday News Roundup, journalist and author Barbara Slavin, Martin Walker of United Press International, and Elise Labatt of CNN. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning and Happy New Year to all of you.
Good morning.
Happy New Year. We've just gotten a report that armed pro-government demonstrators have opened fire on the car of an Iranian opposition leader, shattering its windows, his website reported Friday. What do you know about this, Martin?
Well, what we know is that the Iranian government is launching a real counteroffensive against this green revolution that was building. And really, it's been building since the elections last year, of people believing that it's not just the government of Ahmadinejad, but also the very power structure of the supreme religious leader as well that should now be changed. We've seen a number of facets of this counterattack. There's been some unleashing of the militia, the Basij. There's been a lot of violence and a lot of arrests against the demonstrators. There's been a further crackdown upon things like internet access. And now we have this particularly appalling day in which Karoubi, one of the presidential candidates, was held under siege for several hours by about 500 angry demonstrators outside the building where he was. When he then left, apparently, allegedly under some kind of police or security escort, gunmen then opened fire. So, in other words, it looks like the Iranian regime is now under so much pressure, it's not going to take any prisoners.
And Barbara Slavin, on Monday, 88 professors at Tehran University signed a letter. What do we know about that?
Well, at the same time that we have this extraordinary attack on the opposition, and should mention that the nephew of the chief candidate, Mir Hussein Mousavi, was assassinated not very long ago. So they're threatening the families as well as the opposition candidates. At the same time that we have this going on, we have a series of very urgent pleas from very important constituencies within Iran trying to persuade the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, to compromise in some form or fashion with the opposition before this turns into violence on a regular basis. They're asking for the rights of students to be respected. They're asking for the government to stop attacking students in their dormitories. They said in the letter to the supreme leader that this is not a show of strength, to be attacking students in their dormitories. So there are efforts. There was also a petition that was signed by five very prominent opposition figures who are outside Iran. Again, a plea to the supreme leader for compromise, for steps to de-escalate what looks like it's going to be an escalating crisis in that country.
And Elise, all this goes back to the objected to election.
That's right.
Of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
Well, what we've seen was, since the election, you've had these protests. They were huge after the election, after this intensive crackdown. The opposition have simmered from time to time. But it always pops up. It takes advantage of religious holidays and mourning rites to continue to protest. And as we've said, the regime continues to crack down. But this opposition is not going anywhere. Mousavi said this week that he's willing to be a martyr for his cause. He doesn't mind. But even if you kill him, this opposition is not going away. And the kind of challenging of the authority that we've seen to the supreme leader, to the very heart of the regime, was unthinkable before the election. But now we have to see what happens. I mean, if you look back to the 1979 revolution, it wasn't just a couple of strikes and the revolution was a couple of protests and the revolution was overthrown. You had 2 years of protests. Then we led to strikes. And that's when the regime was so weak it couldn't withstand it anymore. So we have to see now if there are going to be strikes in the country and if this is really going to build momentum over time.
And Martin, five of the protesters who were actually arrested in Iran last week are going to be charged with warring against God, mm-hmm. meaning the death penalty.
It certainly means the death penalty, but don't forget the 10 protesters were shot down about 2 weeks ago in one of the peaks of the riots. It's blasphemy has become the favored charge of this particular regime. After all, on the grounds that the supreme Ayatollah is the representative of God in government. But beyond that, I think we're also seeing, in this way that the regime is fighting back and is taking no prisoners, we're seeing a fairly sophisticated, multi-pronged kind of repression taking place. It's not just internet. It's not just clamping down upon the protesters. It's also manipulating the kind of news that's going out to the public. The real fear of the administration, of the government, is that we're in a state of incipient civil war, in Iran. And what they're terrified of is that the working class, the peasantry, the massively unemployed and rural population might be tempted to join this essentially middle class, essentially intellectually led revolt against the Ayatollahs. And for that reason, the kind of tactics they're using in their manipulation of the media is to claim that these people are against God, that they're heretics, that they're tools of Israel and of the Americans and so on. And there's been some deliberate distortion in some of the news reports in the way that they have used old footage and so on to try and blacken the character of these insurgents.
Barbara.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to work, though. I think most people can see through the propaganda, and they have access to satellite television and many other sources of information, many more than they did even during the revolution in 78, 79.
That's true in the cities. I'm not sure about the rural areas.
It's true pretty much throughout the country, I think, as well. So I think the real danger, yes, is that we see more and more violence. We may see the military stepping in and really taking over in an overt way instead of a covert way. But there is uproar. There was also a story that they have essentially tried to defrock another Ayatollah this week, Ayatollah Sana'i. You've got the clerics up in arms, so many constituencies. It's not just the students. It's not just the urban middle class and the intellectuals who are involved in this now.
What was really remarkable was when you had the demonstrations in Qom, in the holy city, because that was unheard of and that was unprecedented. But I think the real fear now for the government is twofold. One is that this becomes genuinely a mass protest, and there are certainly economic reasons why that should happen. And secondly is that there have been signs in the recent demonstrations that they're losing the support of some of the police and that the police are starting to split. And we know there's been an ongoing tension for years between the army and the Republican Guard, which is much more of a
Revolutionary
kind of a,
Guard.
The Revolutionary Guard, I mean, mm-hmm. which is much more of a religious-based government loyalist operation. And if that happens, then we could actually be seeing a dismantling of the regime.
Ellie.
Well, and also we've seen that, you know, just to your point about the police, I mean, we saw during the immediate protests after the election that some police were working their shifts and going out and trying to quell the crowd and then going home, shedding their uniform and going out on the streets. So you can see that this opposition is a diverse mix of causes. A lot of the clerics are getting involved. And now the regime is putting photos on the internet of protesters that they want to see the besieged go after, or they want people to turn them in. And so they're trying to sow ferment among Iranians themselves.
So we've still got the threat of sanctions at the UN, which China continues to oppose Barbara.
Yeah, it was a particularly unhelpful comment by the Chinese ambassador to the UN. The assumption has been that the United States and at least the Europeans will move toward new sanctions at the UN, probably in February, when I believe France has the presidency of the Security Council rather than China. But most likely, if there are going to be new steps, they're going to come really from the European countries, I think, through the EU. It's unlikely.
What kinds of steps?
Well, the EU is still the biggest trading partner of Iran, even more so than China. And Germany, Italy, France, I believe in that order, do millions and millions of dollars worth of business with Iran.
But
so,
can you see that really making a difference?
Yes. I think it could in some ways if you combine it with other economic steps that are going to happen in Iran. For example, Ahmadinejad has been trying to get through a new system which will reduce or eliminate massive subsidies that are given to people for gas, for bread, for all sorts of necessities. He wants to replace the subsidies, which cost a fortune, with cash payments to the indigent. And he's trying to get this through Parliament. Now, if this is trying to work its way through the system at the same time that there are new pressures from the Europeans that make it more expensive for Iran to import machinery, other goods, it could lead to this economic kind of protest that we have not yet seen against the government, and that really could be decisive.
Also, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said this week that the sanctions that they're looking at could target the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which really has a kind of tentacles throughout all industries within Iranian economy. So it's going after the regime in a way that they're very careful not to hurt the people. And as Barbara said, that looks like the president, Ahmadinejad, will take care of that in itself. But if you're going after all of these tentacles of the Iranian economy, these type of any sanctions you're going to have from the UN aren't going to work. It's these major unilateral sanctions that will have an effect.
Elise Labbitt, she's State Department producer for CNN. Also, here in the studio, Barbara Slavin, she's a journalist and author, and Martin Walker, foreign affairs writer for United Press International. Welcome back to the international portion of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Barbara Slavin. She is the former assistant managing editor at the Washington Times, Martin Walker of United Press International, Elise Labbitt, State Department producer for CNN. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Elise, there's a lot of news out of Yemen this week. Tell us about Yemen's offensive against al-Qaeda and what prompted it.
Well, you've seen the Yemenis going against al-Qaeda for the past several weeks. You started with some strikes on December 17th, another strike on the 24th, and then after the Christmas Day bombing, where it turns out that the bomber was trained and got support from al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, which is based now in Yemen. And so in the last few days, we had a particular attack by the Yemenis to go after one of the men that's believed to be responsible for this Christmas Day bombing, and also believed to be involved in masterminding a threat against the U.S. embassy. The embassy was closed over the weekend, and then Monday it reopened Tuesday after the U.S. said that the Yemenis went after this particular cell.
Barbara.
Yeah, the Yemen situation is quite complex. I remember the good old days when the worst that could happen to you would be you would go there and you'd get kidnapped and well-fed for a couple of weeks and then released for ransom. There used to be a joke about it, in fact, about how pleasant it was to be kidnapped by Yemenis. Country has really changed. The government, central government, is extremely weak. It's fighting two insurgencies in addition to al-Qaeda. It's fighting a Shia rebel group in the north. It's fighting secessionists in the south. There used to be a South Yemen and a North Yemen until about 15, 20 years ago. So they're trying to deal with these secessionist threats, tribal threats, at the same time they're trying to deal with al-Qaeda, and they're not doing a very good job of it.
Is there a really strong government there in Yemen?
No, not at all. The central government is so-called central government is extremely weak, and that's why Yemen has become a sanctuary again for al-Qaeda.
Well, it's a bizarre situation because President Saleh, who is a former general who took over the country, he consolidated his hold upon the country and unified it, bringing in Aden in the south, by allying himself in the 1990s with the jihadists, with the most extreme members of the Islamic religion. Now he's fighting against them. And by bizarrely, al-Qaeda is now climbed into bed in the Yemen with the socialists of the south, even though they have condemned the socialists as godless creatures in the past. It's even more complex than Barbara said. It's not just that you have the Shia group in the north. You also have another separate civil war going on between the Shia and the Sufi group also in the north. And it's
forgive me for leaving that out.
and on top of that, you have an economic disaster because it never had very much oil, but their oil is running out terribly fast.
Let's not leave out the drought. They have the worst drought in 70 years. They're running. Sana'a is about to become the first capital in the world to entirely run out of water.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
What did they do then?
They have to bring it in trucks, I guess, and port it.
They have to move.
Wow!
But it's pretty much a failing state. It's a failing state where the government has lost the majority of its authority, where it's not even sure that they're going to be able to carry on paying for the jet fuel they're using to fuel the MiG jets, and I just don't see any prospect of stability in the short
and
term.
And it's also the place where the Nigerian accused of that Christmas Day attempted bombing met with al-Qaeda there in Yemen.
That's right. And because we've seen that this attack originated in Yemen, I think it alerted people, and you were talking about it in the first hour, and the fact that they didn't realize that al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula was so strong, was in the operational phase of sending people out. But the U.S. has been worried about Yemen for some years. It's not like they just woke up to Yemen. The U.S. has been slowly increasing its aid to Yemen over the past few years. We're going to see a lot more aid this year, in fact, 225% more. However, there's a real checkered past between the United States and Yemen over counterterrorism operations. We've seen specific terrorist suspects that the U.S. has want, al-Qaeda suspects that the U.S. has want the Yemenis to go after. They've been roaming free in the country. The administration, the Bush administration has been furious about this. In fact, in 2006, Condoleezza Rice canceled a trip to Yemen over the Yemenis' refusal to go after these suspects. So now the Obama administration is demanding action, and it puts the president in a difficult situation because Yemen does need help. It does need counterterrorism assistance, more capacity,
and
but they don't want to.
They're refusing U.S. help.
They don't want to be seen. They don't want to be seen as being in the pocket of the U.S. and they're, you know, banging their chest, no troops, no troops. But the U.S. has been providing the Yemenis with intelligence about some of these suspects to go after, and there's some. There's some reports that the U.S. was the one that went after these
drone attacks.
These drone attacks. I mean, the U.S. 24. Isn't obviously admitting to it, but certainly al-Qaeda thinks they are, and that's really the perception is the reality.
It was an airstrike that took out Nasser al-Waishi, who is the head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, on Christmas Eve, and that was almost certainly a U.S.
Right.
operation. But there's been a number of these airstrikes in the past, or drone strikes in the past, which have been deniable by the Yemeni government. because they think it's the kiss of death for them to be seen to be climbing into an alliance with the U.S.
All right. Now, Martin, tell me how much we have learned from Abdul Muttalib since his arrest. First, there was the thought that he'd be interrogated by some military group. Then he was given a civilian lawyer. He stopped talking. Do we know how much we learned before he was given that civilian lawyer?
Well, no, we don't. What we do know is that the U.S. has said officially that he has been giving actionable intelligence on events in
I
Yemen.
I wonder what that means.
Well, that would normally mean that he's giving up names, places, dates, bases, this kind of thing. However, that might not be true. That might be disinformation, because if you really want to upset al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, you say, this guy is singing like a canary and telling us everything, which may or may not be the case. But I think the other bizarre thing is that there have been real signs of disarray in the way the U.S. government is reacting to this. When General Petraeus went there, he said that the 70 million military aid being given to the Yemen was going to be doubled. We then had a statement from the Pentagon saying, well, hang on, we're not sure that's actually the case. This has to go through a review process and so on. And there is there's the usual kind of argument that you get, whether it's in Afghanistan or whether in Iraq, how much of this is going to be a civilian kind of operation, how much of it is going to be a military operation. But the one thing about the key thing about the Obama administration is that they have understood that it is not necessarily smart to reach for the Pentagon every time you have an international crisis. The Pentagon is not necessarily the right answer to everything. But what that does mean is you then have this huge internal debate about the civilian aspect of it all, which costs a lot of money.
Well, there's going to be a conference at the end of January in London about how to give Yemen the kind of assistance it needs, whether it's counterterrorism assistance, but also social and economic assistance, because we've talked about the poverty and the drought and all of these things. And what the administration is saying, there are going to be conditions and expectations of this support. So we're going to see the kind of friends of Yemen, the international community rallying around it like we did with Somalia, like we have with Afghanistan. The question is, do you have the political will on the part of the government to not only accept this assistance, but work with it?
But if there is no real government in place, how do you make sure that this works?
Well, this is the problem. And the very fact fact of saying, as we did in Afghanistan, as we did in Somalia, hardly inspires much confidence about the future.
Well, also, I mean, we've stopped sending detainees from Guantanamo back to Yemen as well, which does not suggest a great level of confidence in the government.
Let's talk about what we have found out regarding the suicide bomber who killed 7 CIA officers in Afghanistan. We know he was a double agent. What else do we know, Barbara?
Well, before we talk about the individual, I think one of the things that's striking, and I still have not seen any good explanation for it, is why this person was allowed into a meeting, not just with the 7 who were killed, but apparently there were 13 people in the room. And I was talking to a former CIA person the other day who said that when someone comes in for an initial meeting, you never have that many people in the room. So there are failures of basic tradecraft here that have to be examined.
Had he not gone in and out of the base several times that day?
I believe this was the first meeting, and apparently he was not searched. I mean, how can you, you know, allow someone into a facility like that with all those CIA people and not search him? So there are a lot of questions, really, about, you know, I don't want to blame the victims for this, but how and why this individual was allowed in without being searched and was with so many people at that time.
It's a really confusing situation. We say that he was a double agent, that he was arrested in Jordan. He's a Jordanian citizen. He was arrested in Jordan. He's a doctor. And the Jordanians thought that they had turned him, that they had made him into an opponent of al-Qaeda, an opponent of the jihadists. He then volunteers his services, allegedly, to the Jordanians, and then by proxy to the Americans, goes to Afghanistan, having told his mother he's going to Turkey initially and then to Pakistan to pursue his medical studies, having told his wife that in fact he was going to pursue his Islamic cause, and his wife says that he was always a very devoted Muslim who believed in martyrdom and so on. So he's clearly telling different things to different members of his family. The question is whether he was a double or a triple agent or what.
Yeah.
It's entirely feasible that having been spotted by Al-Qaeda or by the Taliban in Afghanistan as a likely kind of spy, and they know perfectly well that Jordan's intelligence is hand in glove with the CIA and has been for a long time, they'll be incredibly suspicious of any Jordanian who comes in and says, I want to work with you guys. It's entirely feasible that they then said, we're going to wipe out your entire family unless you wear this explosives belt and go in when you meet your controller. So it's almost like a spy novel that's taking place.
Yeah, but the other question is, what kind of information was he supplying to the CIA?
For several months, he'd been giving apparently decent but fairly low-level information upon medium-ranking local officials. And what they were hoping for was the big enchilada. They hoped that this was the guy who was going to lead them to bin Laden.
This was a very important meeting to the Americans. They were so excited. They sent, I think, the number two CIA official in Afghanistan. They were all geared up. And I mean, it just shows the lack of understanding of Al-Qaeda in the country. Who knew that they were so able to handle such a sophisticated double agent operation? And it's a blow. You know, the question I think now is, you know, what do you do? Does this make you more risk adverse? Or do you recognize that we need better intelligence
methods? How
about
searching people before they come into your compound?
Well,
you know?
I mean, what does it say about who Americans can trust?
Well, what does it say about the CIA that the U.S. has now been deeply involved in Afghanistan for 8 years and has got apparently zero effective agents, informants on the ground?
Well, it shows how dependent they are on countries like Jordan and other countries, and the idea that the U.S. can do this without countries that have understanding of the region, I mean, I think is a fallacy. But, I mean, you know, these things are bound to happen. Intelligence is a dangerous business, and I think they just need to regroup and figure out how they're going to avert something like this in the future.
Elise Labbitt of CNN, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's open the phones first to Willeen in Patchogue, New York. You're on the air.
Yes, how are you, folks?
Fine, thank
you. I would like to address something very important. It has to do with synchronicity and synchronous bombings that have occurred in Kabul and in Baghdad. And I think what they're doing is practicing. I think they're practicing synchronicity so that they come to the homeland and they will do something here. There's been too many synchronous bombings occurring in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now we're taking it to Pakistan. And it's been too much for me to cope with, and I'd like to bring it to your attention and address it at this point in time.
Martin Walker.
Well, I mean, this is absolutely right that there have been a whole number
of separate
bombing campaigns, some of them taking place in Pakistan, some of them in Afghanistan, and so on. The question is whether this is centrally organized or not. And that, I think, the jury is still out on this. There is a lot of evidence that there's a great deal of independent terrorist action, independent terrorist cells taking place. Certainly, that's what we've seen in Europe, in Britain, in Germany, in France, in Belgium, where we've seen various Al-Qaeda or pro-Al-Qaeda cells being arrested. It seems that there's been very little central Al-Qaeda direction of them. And so I'm not at all sure that there is some kind of mastermind sitting in a cave in Waziristan and saying, right, if it's Tuesday, the bombing must be Pakistan. If it's Wednesday, it must
Simon
be
Simon Editor, as we call them.
I think there's there's a terrifying and growing number of enthusiastic volunteer martyrs out there who are prepared to carry on despite everything that the Obama administration has tried to signal about a new U.S. approach towards Islam and towards the war on terror.
All right, let's go to Arlington, Virginia. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Diane. I have two questions. My first is, What does the long-term impact of Iranian unrest have on foreign relations with Syria and Hezbollah? And specifically, will this impact the Middle East peace process if Syria decides to pull away from Iran? Second question is, I think we can expect that Yemen is going to become, at some time in the future, a failed state. If that is the case, what is U.S. policy going to be then, and particularly with our relations with Saudi Arabia in dealing with the problem, remembering that Saudi Arabia fought a war at the beginning of this century and took territory in what is now southwestern Saudi Arabia away from Yemen?
That's a lot of questions. Go ahead and start, Barbara.
Yeah, why don't I do Iran and somebody else can do Yemen.
Sure.
It's a terrific question about the regional implications, and I think Iran's domestic unrest is weakening it very significantly in the region. There are already reports of some differences between leaders of Hezbollah and the Iranians. I think they're very nervous that the supreme leader will not be able to maintain control. They're worried about continuing to get supplies, particularly of weapons, from Iran. The Syrians have been flirting with the Obama administration for quite some time, and this gives them more reason to do that. And I think the administration would be wise to try to capitalize on that and send an ambassador to Syria.
Barbara Slavin, she's journalist and author. We'll have to take a look at some of those other questions when we come back. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Hey, Paul from Staten Island.
Hey,
what we got tonight?
Hey, what's up, dog? I gotta tell you, I am feeling good tonight.
The movie Big Fan, about an obsessed fan of sports radio call-in shows, comes out on DVD next week. On The Next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the director, Robert Siegel, and the star of the film, Patton Oswalt. Join us.
Quantrell's back, baby.
Now that's a G-Men fan.
Oh,
thanks,
thank
buddy.
You. All right, okay. Thanks, sports dog. Thank you.
And just before the break, we had some awfully good questions from Bob in Arlington, Virginia. I gather, Martin Walker, you're going to take on the next.
Well, yes, he asked us a whole series of questions, which Barbara answered the first one, I think, which was about the regional impact. He made the point about Saudi Arabia's involvement in the Yemen, which is absolutely true. Historically, Saudi Arabia has been encroaching upon the Yemen, and indeed the Saudis are part, there's been a kind of border warfare in northern Yemen. The Saudis have been involved in some airstrikes and in some other, we think, covert operations against that Shia civil war. This is a big problem because the Shia are very worried about Saudi Arabia, which is such a powerful, such a passionately Sunni state. So that adds to the complications of this failing state of the Yemen. The final thing that I think we have to sort of point out on the Middle Eastern peace process is that there is a second clock ticking. It's not just the clock of this incipient civil war in Iran. It's the progress of their move towards acquiring nuclear status, whether, as they say, it is simply nuclear, peaceful nuclear power, or whether, as almost everybody else in the world says, it looks like they're heading for nuclear weapons. And it looks like they're very close indeed. I mean, the IAEA says they've now got, looks like they've now got 1.5 tons of enriched uranium. It's certainly enough for one or perhaps two bombs.
All right, to Dunbarton, New Hampshire. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning. I wanted to say that while going back to Yemen, the situation there is very dire, but I do think there is some it's not analogous to Somalia or some such place, and that needs to be taken into account in these conversations. I'm a development professional. I've spent a good deal of time in Yemen, and the central government, absolutely, it has very little control outside of the capital region, and there's numerous problems, not to mention drug abuse, along with all, everything else that was listed. But the regime is more representative than some of the places that were mentioned as comparable. There is some history of central government in the south, at least, not so much in the north. And my own experience, basically, is that while the place is deeply troubled, it's not as yet a sinking ship.
All right, Elise.
Well, I think that's a good point, and I think that the administration wants to make sure that it doesn't become a failed state, and that's why this week Secretary Clinton was talking a lot about development, not just in Yemen but around the world, and she says we need to get to these places before they become failed states, and that's why you're going to see a lot of attention towards social and economic development in Yemen, not only to for counterterrorism but to help the administration of President Saleh help the country develop.
Would you agree Yemen is not analogous to Somalia?
I think it's getting there. The stability that one has had in the past in the Yemen has been based upon, broadly speaking, subsidies to the various tribal and ethnic groups, mm-hmm. which have been coordinated by President Saleh, who, after all, himself comes from the Zaidi area of the north. The difficulty is that because of the declining oil exports and oil sales, he's running out of money to keep this kind of game of subsidies and paying particular tribal leaders. He's just running out of money to carry on with that routine. And it's terribly difficult anyway to do development in an underdeveloped country. To try and do it, the civilian development, in the middle of civil war and in the middle of violence is almost impossible.
All right, to Boca Raton, Florida. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
Morning.
I have a question. On last night on the Rachel Maddow show, I can't remember the gentleman's name. He broke the story on Blackwater, but Jeremy Scahill. He stated that there were two of the agents who were killed in a suicide bombing were with Blackwater, and my question is, to what extent is Blackwater still involved in American military operations?
Barbara.
That's a good question. Yeah, two of the people who were killed were contractors who came from Blackwater. It's now called Z, I believe. It's changed its name. And, of course, as you know, there have been a number of questions about that company's involvement. Again, I mean, this is one of the issues. The U.S. government does not have sufficient personnel to do many of the tasks of fighting this war on terror or terrorism, whatever you want to call it, and there is a tremendous amount of contracting. That I'm sure even if you look at the terrorist watch list, my former employer, we had quite a good story that John Brennan, the president's terrorism advisor, was in charge of a company that was involved in providing information to those who formulate the terrorist watch list. This was a private company. So where is the line between government and contractor?
And
you know, it's very hard to find.
Here's an email from Diane in New Hampshire. She says, what has been the Iraqi public's reaction to the dismissal of charges against Blackwater Security stemming from their 2007 shooting in Baghdad's Nisour Square? Barbara.
Furious. Absolutely furious. I don't think they understand why the charges were dropped at all.
And why were the charges dropped? Do we know?
Apparently lack of evidence to secure a conviction. But Barbara's absolutely right. Not just in Iraq, the Arabian press in general and media have been outraged by this.
All right, to Syracuse, New York. Hi there, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane. I love your show.
I'm so glad.
My question is, if we take it for granted that a fragile government, such as in Yemen and Somalia too, is going to have trouble if we help them out too much, why can we not funnel lots of humanitarian aid, maybe even military aid, through our allies in the area like Morocco, Jordan, et cetera?
Elise.
Well, I think that that's what you've been trying to do, not just on Yemen, and we're going to see this meeting at the end of the month, which is going to have all the neighbors, but in Afghanistan, but in Iraq. I mean, this has been a policy of the U.S. for, you know, since this war on terror and the war in Iraq began, to try and get the neighbors involved. And it's not going to be covertly. It's going to be overtly to show that, you know, everybody is wanting to help build up these countries.
And yet we know that what happens when al-Qaeda sees something like the UN come in to coordinate humanitarian operations is they target the UN. They did so in Afghanistan, in Kabul. They did so in Iraq, in Baghdad. And this is part of the problem of putting together these operations of
That's
friends of wherever it might
and
be.
And what about the departing chief of the UN Afghanistan mission? He had some very harsh words about U.S. policy, Barbara.
Yeah, well, Kai Eide is the official, and he said that the United States was in danger with a surge of emphasizing military rather than civilian aid to Afghanistan. But I think, in fairness, Kai Eide has not the best reputation in the world either. He's leaving a bit under a cloud questions about how well the United Nations managed the elections that Afghanistan had last year, accusations that Kai Eide was not doing a particularly good job, and I've heard a lot of complaints that the UN mission there is not very well focused either. It's very tough. Who do you trust? There's tremendous corruption in these places. A lot of the money winds up in the wrong hands. A lot of the money goes to contractors, again, who may or may not perform well and who may spend most of it on SUVs and bodyguards. So I don't think anybody has yet found the formula. Maybe Greg Mortensen, who I heard you interview not long ago, you know, building schools and whatnot.
Yes.
You know, you need to get down at the grassroots. You need to eliminate as much overhead as possible, and governments are not very good at doing that.
Well, one interesting thing that the U.S. Rolled out this week is this agriculture program for Afghanistan, and this is what they're calling the biggest non-security priority in Afghanistan. Years ago, decades ago, the country used to be the biggest agricultural exporter. The U.S. says that, you know, some think it's a foolhardy plan, but that if you can have alternative crops, about 80% of the population are farmers. If you can give them jobs, if you can help develop the country that way, that this is going to help Afghanistan not only become an extracultural exporter, but also create jobs and create the kind of development that we're not seeing on these USAID projects
My
of roads and things like that.
My friend Martin looks very skeptical.
Well, I think it's very difficult to put a lot of effort behind a successful agricultural operation when, with the other hand, the U.S. government is doing its best to wipe out the most profitable cash crop that the Afghan ecosystem
has got,
which is to say opium, which is to say drugs. Tony Blair offered President Bush back in 2003, he said, look, what we ought to do in Afghanistan is agree to buy up the entire opium crop, then burn it. Or turn it into anesthetics or something. But you cannot fight this kind of counterinsurgency developmental campaign while at the same time losing friends, losing the influence of people.
But is that idea of buying up the opium crop still around?
There's still some talk about it, but the question is, you know, how sustainable is something like that?
Right.
They want to create an alternative economy.
It's a great deal cheaper than spending $1 million
All
per
right.
soldier.
Let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Bruce.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I'm an American Iranian, and at the time of Shah, we had people against Shah, but now we have people against the government, and we have Basiji. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous here.
Oh, don't be. Go right ahead.
And I'm afraid if even people defeat the government or regime, then we have fanatics and Basijis go underground. Then we have a situation like Iraq with suicide bombers and maybe a civil war. And I have a question. What is the possibility of a coup d'etat?
Led by whom? It's not a trick question. I think that the one area where you might possibly get some kind of coup d'etat would have to be from the army, which was the kind of body which would have the force to be able to make it stick. The difficulty is that, of course, the Republican Guard and the regime has been monitoring every promotion and every posting inside the officer corps of the Iranian army with a precise eye on preventing that from happening. So my guess is that if there were to be some kind of internal military revolt, it would probably have to come from some kind of faction within the Guard itself rather than just the military.
I think the caller pointed up something very, very important, which is that Iran has already had an experience of a revolution that completely overturned the system, that killed thousands of people, executed many, many more, millions left the country. And I think the hope of a lot of the opposition figures now is that this really can be nonviolent, that this can be evolutionary rather than revolutionary. The problem is, as we have seen, that the government so far is not willing to give an inch. Although we did neglect to mention one thing. There were reports that the former prosecutor of Tehran might be charged in the abuses that took place at an informal prison in the south of Tehran, where a number of people were tortured and people were raped. So if we begin to see the regime give a little bit, perhaps there's a possibility that there can be an evolutionary and rather than a revolutionary change.
Well, and also, as we were saying before, you've kind of seen disaffection, not just from clerics, but from some members of the army, some members of the police. And I think another hope of the opposition is that that will grow and that you're going to see the kind of not defection, but disaffection within the ranks of the military structure, which could grow and then have a revolution of that kind.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Diane. I had a quick question for you. Considering the two lawsuits, the one in the United States with Blackwater that was settled and the one in Iraq that was dropped, I've been hearing a lot more news, especially around the world in Pakistan and in Iraq, that people are so angry at Iraq and that this is really the number one thing driving hatred of the United States. And I was curious if your guests could comment on that.
Martin.
Well, there's certainly been a wave of outrage about this because I think the incident that triggered all of this, which was the shooting of a number of Iraqi civilians at a roundabout in Baghdad, allegedly by Blackwater guards, security guards, has been almost like Abu Ghraib in the kind of symbolic impact that it's had about the way in which the U.S. has conducted its operations inside Iraq. And so to have this deeply unsatisfactory, deeply uncertain verdict, I think has outraged people. And it's not just an isolated example. When I mention Abu Ghraib, it's not just that. It's Guantanamo. The hopes of the change that spread through the Middle East after Obama's Cairo speech, I think, have been steadily whittled away, partly by the failure to close Gitmo, partly by this kind of non-judicial result,
and
partly by the airstrikes.
Certainly, considering this attempted bombing, Guantanamo is going to take an awful lot longer to close.
Well, they've already been having trouble not just with taking third countries to get some of the nationals, but agreements with countries to take their nationals and watch them and provide security. And we've seen, there's a Pentagon report that is floating around this week, a classified report that 1 in 5 released Guantanamo detainees goes back to some kind of terror activity. And that's what's really going to make it difficult now for the Obama administration to continue to let these detainees, as we saw, the president said that no more are going back to Yemen. The Saudis do have some rehabilitation program, which does have some success. But I think now this report that 1 in 5 detainees are going back to some kind of terrorist activity or suspected of terrorist activity, that is very scary.
If you want to know how outraged the Islamic world is, despite giving something like $7.5 billion to Pakistan, this week the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan filed a formal complaint about the harassment and the detention of U.S. diplomats moving around Pakistan, trying actually to disburse the money for some of these civilian developments. I mean, even our so-called friends like Pakistan are behaving in this kind of way. It's as though the Islamic world doesn't think there's been any real change since the Bush administration left office.
Would you agree with that, Barbara?
I think maybe that's overstating it a little bit. But it is very difficult, I mean, for the United States, for the Obama administration, to be prosecuting two wars still in the region, to be continuing all these drone attacks, so much emphasis on the military, and not experience this sort of backlash from the Muslim world.
Yeah, the Pakistani internal minister said just last week, 568 Pakistani civilians killed by U.S. drone attacks.
Martin Walker, Barbara Slavin, Elise Labatt. Quite a roundup, you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.